Bien, je vous propose de commencer le séminaire d'aujourd'hui. Nous avons beaucoup de chance aujourd'hui de recevoir comme professeur invité au Collège de France pour deux exposés pendant une quinzaine de jours. Le professeur Andrea Moreau, qui vient de l'Institut d'études avancées qui s'est créé à Pavie, en Italie. Andrea Moreau est l'un des grands spécialistes de l'étude des langues et particulièrement de la question de l'universalité derrière la diversité des langues, ce qu'il appelle les frontières de Babel. Et il est aussi un linguiste qui a fait des contributions fondamentales dans la compréhension de l'organisation des langues, mais aussi un linguiste qui n'a pas hésité, en particulier lorsqu'il était, voici quelques années, à l'hôpital San Raffaele à Milan, à s'intéresser aux liens entre linguistique et organisation du cerveau, des mécanismes du langage dans le cerveau, ce qui est assez rare parmi les linguistes. Et il est l'auteur d'une publication particulièrement remarquable sur ce sujet dans Nature Neuroscience, qui est l'une des plus grandes revues dans le domaine des neurosciences, en utilisant l'imagerie cérébrale pour étudier la manière dont le cerveau considère certaines langues comme possibles ou comme impossibles. C'est le sujet de son exposé aujourd'hui, les frontières de Babel, le cerveau et l'énigme des langues impossibles. Donc sans plus tarder, et en vous remerciant beaucoup, cher Andrea, je vous laisse la parole.
Thank you very much for your introduction. And I want to start with this. Malheureusement, mon français, ça reste là. But I choose this quotation for two reasons. The first reason that it belongs, it's a sort of a synthesis of what we should all mean when we search the origin of language as the origin of man, in a sense. And the other is that there is a mistake in most of the translation of this, which belongs to Oedipus Rex, Oedipus King, actually. And the mistake is the translation of the two words origine. Actually, all the Italian translation got the origine. The mistake comes from the fact that in ancient Greek, the two words were completely different. You have to sperma, the seed, in the first one, and ogenos, the origin, in the second. And I find it extremely interesting, the fact that in order to understand your origin, that is, your ancestors, you got to get through the seed that forms you as an individual. So I always have that in the back of my mind since I started as a student. Then what I would like to do today is to try to offer you, unfortunately I realized it last night that I didn't put French in the product, in the Cartesian disposition of that, but the cart is always in the back of everything that I say, so perhaps you excuse me for that. The idea today is to go through the relationship between language variation and the architecture of the brain. And to do so, of course, I decided not to get too formal, too didascalic, but I wanted to do something different, to go through an empirical question. The empirical question is very simple to formulate, and it's the following. Why aren't all conceivable grammars realized in the languages of the world? Of course, to understand that, which is one of the greatest achievements of 20th century linguistics, we have to know what a conceivable grammar is. So let me give you a very simple example. Let's call it the global inversion example. Everybody knows that if you want to go from an affirmative sentence in English, like John is happy to is John happy, you just permute the number of words in the sequence. Now, suppose that all the people gathered here in this room and all the people at Collège de France, for example, want to have a secret code to communicate via email. And for example, decide that a negative sentence that we're going to type right to each other will be formed by inverting all the words in the same of the affirmative sentence that it corresponds to. It would be extremely easy. Something like, he asked to go home, if we mean he didn't ask to go home, will become something like home go to ask the, that is, just permuting all the words. It's very easy to learn. In fact, we already learned it. If we go home tonight, we try to, particularly the two of us, when we try to exchange our emails, sometimes we make errors of this kind biased by our experiments. So it's clearly the case that it would be very easy to do. Nevertheless, there is no language in the world that allows for global inversion. Why is it so? is it because of a historical, cultural fact, or does it have anything behind it to be explained? This question, in fact, should be sort of embedded in a larger question that, to me, is the great new challenge that we're facing nowadays in the field of linguistics and neuropsychology in general. There's one thing we all know. We all know that language depends on the brain activity since at least the 19th century. This happened, in fact, when a guy named Monsieur Le Borgne, the famous Tintin patient, went to the hospital in Bicêtre here in Paris and was just able to do everything but much speaking. He just had one single syllable, and he was using, you know, the expression on the face, and, you know, much in the sense that Dario Fo does when he speaks and he does theater, but he was only saying tan. So that was the first time that people were able to have a serious theory of connection between language and the brain. Interestingly enough, in the history of medicine, it was not always the case that language was centered in the brain. We know, for example, that Aristotle considered the heart the center of the cognitive function. We still have a residue that in languages, in English, for example, you know, we say something when we have something in our memory, we say we have something, we know something by heart, not because of the romantic effect of the English native speakers, but because of the fact that it was a cardiocentric psychology in that case. So what's the new challenge? The new challenge is not the relationship of language and the brain, but the new question is whether the format of grammar depends on the structure of the brain as well. That is, whether, for example, the impossible rules that we're discovering are due to something that pertains to the architecture of the brain itself. There is the next citation that I want to show you should highlight a major problem in this kind of research. That is when ideology sneaks in research programs, and sometimes it blocks research in a sense that it's not always transparent, and we have to be very aware of that. Let me first of all read it for you. A biological investigation into language must seem paradoxical, as it is so widely assumed that languages consist of arbitrary cultural convention. This sentence is not recent. It is recent. I was trying to say the opposite. It was not ancient. It was just written less than 50 years ago in a preface of the Foundation of Biological Foundation of Language by Lenneberg, a book that sort of establishes the first very interesting comments on language. And so you perfectly understand that if you start from this point of view, actually trying to explore the format of grammars doesn't make sense. Because if it is conventional, it would be like searching for the area of the brain that tells you to stop when you see a red light. You can imagine a kind of world where you stop when you see a green light and you go when it is red light. That world is called Italy. No, I mean, I'm joking, but if you try to drive in my country, sometimes you figure out how difficult it is. But you understand the problem. If it is a conventional thing, then it's gone forever. But if it's true, if it's truly architectural, then we have to find a way to understand it. The next step will be the obvious one. There was a very interesting essay on Galileo by an Italian philosopher in the last century, Ludovico Geymanat. He wrote an essay on Galileo saying that the major step that Galileo had, methodologically speaking, was not to widen the domain of physics, but rather to do the opposite, that is to strengthen to the limit, to observe only one single thing. This is what we normally do in science, and we do that in linguistics too. What we do here, what I would like to offer you, is the idea that instead of looking at the totality of possible rules and structures of language, I will just concentrate on syntax for three reasons. The first reason is that the syntax appears to be the fingerprint of human code with respect to all the other animals. This, for example, was proved by... proved is not exactly the correct word when you make empirical science. It was strongly supported by the work by Laura and Petito, who is now in Toronto, when she did the works on teaching language to a monkey, to a chimpanzee. The second reason is that syntax allows mathematical formalization. So rather than going through intuition on meaning or other mystical aspects of communication, you can get through theorems. And the third reason is that I'm paying to be a synthetician. That doesn't make syntax more interesting than other things, but at least one of the things that I can do is just to go through that with much more a sense of understanding what I'm doing. The thing that I'm reading here is allegedly something that is clear for most non-linguists. For the linguist, it's still debated for some paradoxical situation. It was a sentence pronounced by Steve Anderson when he was president of the Linguistic Society of America. As usual, when you give a talk in presence of all the affiliates of a society, you don't want to go through very, you know, controversial theories. You want to say something that everybody agrees with. And this is what he was saying. The communication system of all other known animals are based on a limited set of discrete messages, and one that cannot be expanded by combining elements to form new and different complex messages. So again, everything I will say from now on will just concentrate on syntax. That is, on the capacity that we human have to get two sentences out of three words. For example, if I tell you John, Peter, hit, you can say John hit Peter and Peter hit John. This is, in a nutshell, what syntax is. It's something where you make up new meaning out of order of things. There is a preliminary step, because if I want to get you through the exploration of what I call the boundaries of Babel, namely whether or not the limits that are imposed on languages belong to the structure of the brain or not, we first have to know whether syntax is autonomously represented in the brain. In fact, we ask if syntax is a descriptive artifact established in the 4th century before Christ, or if it reflects an autonomous neurobiological activity in the brain. Notice that the very two key terms of modern linguistics, semantics and syntax, are very asymmetric in terms of when they came about. One, it was at least established in the fourth century before Christ, that is syntax, whereas semantics, from Real, is only on the late 19th century. So it's already interesting, the fact that the two terms came about in two very different moments. In order to try to prove that what we call syntax is not a descriptive artifact, something that you just design in order to explain or to teach or to understand how language works, but it corresponds to how the brain works, we can, of course, use new tools. The new tools that I've been lucky to get access to, not because of any particular intelligence of mine, but just because I found someone who, you know, dared to listen to what the linguist had to say about that, was a neuropsychologist. And in fact, a medical doctor in San Raffaele, Stefano Cappa, who decided that there could be a contact between linguistics and neuropsychology. The machine that we use in that case was a machine that allowed to overcome the major problem that you had in the 19th century when you had to explore the brain. And you had to wait for the, first of all, you had to wait for a patient. And second, you had to wait for the patient to die. And so if you explore a language, as you can imagine, it's not a very easy situation. Now what you do here is you measure blood perfusion or blood flow, and you get information on the local metabolism in the brain. And this is, of course, by hypothesis, correlated to the neural activity in the brain. It's, again, in that case, my friend Professor Stanahan would be much more qualified than me to explain all the not only the details, but the profound methodological issues that are at stake here. But let's try to be simple as possible, because of what I need to tell you wouldn't involve too many deep observation on that thing. But there is one thing that I want to mention immediately here. That is the limit of this technology. As all tools, it has a limit. And the first immediate limit that you have with this kind of tool is that there are no immediate data. When I first started looking at this machine, I thought I found, you know, the philosopher's stone of the linguist, something that you could go through and understand the whole structure of the brain. It was not the case. If there are no pathologies, the brain cortex and the brain self is always active in all its parts, as requested by the metabolism related to different cognitive and motor activities. So here, for example, is a PET scan of a brain at rest. We now even know that a brain at rest does something very interesting, like Reckl, discovered in the default mode. But as you see here, if I just ask you to lay down on a chair and not think of anything, you cannot just stop a part of the brain. All your brain will be active. So I cannot just ask you to do something and look with that machine and take a picture of that activity. So we have a first dogma to accept, as in all part of our lives, we have to face dogmas. And the first dogma is the dogma of comparison. That is, when you do neuroimaging to study brain activity by measuring blood perfusion, we must at least compare two distinct activities or two different moments of the same activity. This, for example, was carried out in a very famous work by Friston. Let me give you one example of what I'm saying now. Suppose I ask you to try to figure out what part of the brain allows you to do this, right? Moving the fingers on the thumb of your left hand. If I just ask you, Stan or Franco or Zaf or other friends here, to go inside of the machine and doing this, of course, depending on what they are focusing in that moment, one has to pay for the next grant, the other also, I don't know, all the things that you may think of. So the whole brain will be completely devoted to do other things plus this. So one thing I can do is the following. I can measure the activity of the brain when you don't do anything and compare that when you do this. What is the assumption? The assumption is that the part of the brain that is doing the same thing in both situations will require the same kind of energy, thus the same amount of blood. So if you take the same amount of blood out of the same amount of blood, it gets zero. So only where you get a difference, that part, by assumption, is the one that was involved in that thing. Of course, I have to make sure that the people participating in the experiment don't think about too many different things. So I have to sort of synthesize their minds onto something simple. One possibility is the following. For example, I ask them to count from 100 to 0, let's say odd numbers. Second measure, I ask them to do the same and move the fingers on the thumb. Third measure, I compare the first one to the second. The comparison is made mathematically, but visually, what you obtain in the end is something like this. The difference between the two activities has to be related to the difference in the brain. So you say that doing this correlates with an activity in the contralateral part of the brain in a certain position. Now, you understand immediately what the problem is. If we accept the dogma of comparison, that is, if in order to understand a task, we have to go through a comparison, then we have to make it sure that it can do that with cognitive tasks. So we have an immediate, straightforward question. How can the subtraction method be used to isolate syntax? Of course, I cannot, in that case, ask a person to go inside of the machine and then speak with syntax and then speak without syntax, because you all understand that speaking without syntax would make no sense, hopefully. It means that syntax is an inherent part of our language. We cannot just suspend it as if it were a movement of the hand or the thumbs on the hand. You have to use syntax. So we're stuck. If the methodological assumption is to stop and reintroduce an activity to compare, we're stuck when it comes to, at least with language, with this thing that we want to do, that is, try to see if syntax is represented in the brain. Then we decided to do something different. We decided to fool the brain, so to speak. Since syntax is a definitory property of language, thus one cannot simply suppress syntax to get a contrast, we decided to do the following thing. To isolate syntax via subtraction, an original strategy was invented. We made specific error at different levels of representation, hoping to stimulate selective neural network. That is, since I cannot ask you to speak without syntax, I'll do something different. I try to construct syntactic errors and see if you react to the syntactic errors in a different way with respect to phonological errors, for example, or other type of errors. Now, as usual, in science, whenever you find a way, you always find a counterway that asks you for more refinement. And one immediate problem that we had was the following. Suppose I give you all a sentence with the wrong syntax. Are we sure that this does not affect any other component of grammar? No, we're not. I'll give you one example. Suppose I tell you that a tiger has killed a hen. You understand what it is because, you know, you know the words and the word order. Now, suppose I destroy the syntax of this sentence and I just say, AA has tiger hen killed. I just phone you from the jungle in a hurry and I tell you, AA has tiger hen killed. You still understand what happened because of the fact that you know what a hen is, what a tiger is, and what kill means, assuming that avian flu is not spread around, that it is sufficient for a chicken to sneeze in front of a tiger in order to kill the tiger. But I still hope that this example will, you know, last forever. This sentence is not computable. Is still computable because of the meaning of computable because of the meaning of the words in there. But suppose the sentence is the following: a snake has killed a hen. Then if I destroy the syntax, you don't understand what's going on because of the case. It could be the case that a snake kills a hen, or vice versa, right? So if the strategy is to make errors, to isolate syntax, I better find a way not to involve semantics, because otherwise any result that I have would call for a semantic activity. So we decided to do what scientists sometimes do in their life, that is to play. And we decided to play with words by eliminating lexical roots. Now what I'm doing here, this is an experiment, a famous experiment that corresponds to the activity they have in your brain when you look inside of the dictionary in your brain. For example, now you're online looking at the words I'm saying. Some of the words come for free because if I say adjective, nouns, and words, you're here in a talk concerning language, you understand that. But if I say strawberry right now, for example, in your dictionary, you have to go quickly through another chapter and try to see where that is. But the interesting fact is that your brain will be completely fooled if I give you a sentence like the following. Now, at this point, the audience splits because the stimuli I'm going to presenting in immediate, I will do something different in a minute, are only valid for Italian native speaker, but I hope that you get some of the idea when I read them. Il gulco gianigeva la brala, na fantavano gli oprammi, il lapento non tonce mai, quella molmeca non anidava questa frida. Believe me, none of these sentences make sense for an Italian. Il gulco gianigeva la brala might sound some waiter trying to offer you a new type of pasta, possibly. But still, it doesn't make any sense. So you cannot actually say whether it's true or false. Could be that the gulco gianigeva la brala, or he did not. He or it or she or whatever that is. There are some interesting sub-aspects on this class of words, though. For example, most of the speakers tended to assume that they were animals. This is per se a very interesting argument, because if you give a fake word to a human, how come that of all the possible repertoire, he always picks up the animal? Possibly because we have to be scared by animals, not by flowers. Nobody has ever been, you know, followed by a dangerous daisy in the dark. But, you know, if it happens, maybe we will develop the capacity to assign this word to other name. But then, and I hope it makes sense, I try to let you think that you're all part of the experiment, and I tell you the following very important things. Le gulc janigé le bral. I hope it doesn't make sense first, and I hope it does not sound in any possible way ambiguous to you. That's the danger when you play with words in other languages. So forgive me if it has a dirty meaning beneath it or something like that. Assuming that it does not, see what it happens. Read that. You actually immediately know that there is an error. And of course, it's not your liver telling you that there is an error in that. It has to be a part in the brain. It's a phonological error. The sequences of consonants is not part of French. You can pronounce that, but it's not part of French. Now the following. Still, another mistake, right, Stan? And the mistake here is not in terms of phonology, is not in terms of syntax, it's in terms of morphosyntax. You have chosen the wrong agreement. Now what is missing? We have words in the right order, the right agreement, the wrong sound, words in the right order, the right sound and the wrong agreement, there is only one missing. This is words with the wrong order, the right sound, and the right agreement. And this is syntax. Now we have all the ingredients to proceed through the dogma of comparison. We will try to see if what happened in your brain when you recognized the three different types of errors, different networks were activated. And we were very lucky because of the fact that only when the syntactic error were detected, these two parts of the brain, or the brain plus some other, were activated. That is Broca's area, not surprisingly, plus the nucleus caudatus, an inner part of the brain of the left nucleus caudatus, an inner part of the brain constituted the group, the so-called basal ganglia. So let me summarize so far, because remember, we are in a preliminary step so far. We are trying to see if it is plausible to say that syntax is autonomously represented in the brain. So we have a first empirical result. Yes, the study showed that the selective role of a deep component of Broca area and subcortical elements in syntactic processing. The same strategy modulo the fact that they use real words was done in another interesting experiment by Embick and Marantz and others. But they did not play with the semantic thing. And then, for those of you who are interested in epistemological things in the large sense, this experiment revealed a strong convergence between theoretical linguistic models that goes back to 2,400 years ago, the one that individuated syntax as a component of grammar, and the understanding of how the brain appears to work right now. There is an interesting fact here. I learned from my maestri, including Stan in this case, that the result in neurobiology are very delicate things. It is sometimes the case that you cannot even replicate them in your own lab. And when you can do that in different labs, it's just a lucky thing. There is a paper that I want to mention here. To me, it's one of the most interesting papers that I read in the recent years, that was aiming at discovering the differences between certain aspects of rational thought, for example, syllogism or certain kind of construction made with word, and grammar. The work was led by Daniel Osherson, and they still discovered that when they not only they discovered that thought, in the sense of rational thought conveyed by words, activated a different error with respect to grammar, but he also observed again that the nucleus caudatus was active when the specific syntactic error were made. Now we can go back to Babel. What did we gain so far? We gained only one thing. You decide whether it's a big or a small thing. But we now know that syntax corresponds to a certain network inside of the brain. It's not only an artifact of the scientist. And so we can rephrase the original question that I started with. Why aren't all conceivable grammar realized in the language of the world? I immediately realized when I presented this talk in the first time, there could be an easy way to answer that. If you see this map of the world, which is sort of upside down, with a scale, it's just our geographical story of our species that takes, we were, as human born in Africa at a certain point, 150 years ago. In that case, the dates are not very, are not written on stone. You have to be careful about that. But there could be one very easy answer to the absence of certain types of grammars. The first couple were either the female or the male had a mutation that had language, choose one type of grammar. And then since we are all cousins, in fact, coming from the first couple, it could well be that the absence of certain type of rules come from the fact that those rules were not present in the first grammar. If that is a story, that's kind of trivial. It is so because it was just decided. Well, there are two things we can do. Wait for another 100,000 years, and doing what we do to our environment, it's not just a very serious idea. And the other thing is to play and to see if we can do something different. The object that you see here, which is obviously very well known for all of you, is a sort of a synthesis of the methods that all linguists do. That is, they compare. They compare things together. The new fact that we do now, compared to what happened in the 19th century, is the following. To understand whether the absence is accidental, the absence of certain rules, cultural, conventional, or it rather correlates with the neuropsychological architecture of the brain, one can test the brain reaction to an impossible grammar. This is the core of today's talk. To tell you that if a linguist is able to identify the base structure of a grammar, he's also able to create an impossible grammar and see how the brain reacts. If the brain doesn't do anything, we're not allowed to say anything. But if the brain reacts to that, then we're at least allowed to say that it cannot be only conventional, cultural, and blah, blah, blah. The thing that I have to do now is to give you a recipe for impossible grammar, because I do want you to have an idea of how we proceed in our research, how we build this grammar. And to construct an impossible grammar, we must preliminarily know what are the invariant aspects of grammar across languages. Now, there is a thing that perhaps is just useful to me, but I want to share that with you. It's something that I used to do when I was a kid that I could not reveal to anyone. Well, there is a number of things that I could not reveal, but the one that I'm going to tell you here is something that can be revealed, at least not now. When I went to museum, there is a museum in Pavia with the tapestry of the Battle of Pavia, where the French destroyed Pavia, but needless to say, we don't blame anyone right here now. And so what I did when I was a kid was get close to the tapestry and look at the small part of the tapestry. So you see all the little dots of color that create this immense tapestry. And then do the following thing. Look beneath that. And what you saw beneath that was complete chaos, apparently, because all the signs were different. So I couldn't picture the tapestry because now I'm an adult and I'm not allowed to do things that kids may do. But I can give you the idea by looking at something like this. Hopefully no one gets into the room right now because otherwise they would think that they have to the wrong talk. But if you look at this thing, for example, you see the red dots that you see over here. They're totally unrelated in the tapestry. But now what you happen if you turn the tapestry upside down, you see that the dots are in fact strictly connected. And there is a relationship between two elements that appear on one side. So this is basically what linguists do. They look beneath sentences, trying to find the tapestry that connects words at a distance, as if they were trying to explore the shape of a tapestry. In a sense, this model of explanation that is try to combine things and see beneath them is nothing but an old vice of structuralism. And this is declared in Chomsky 1981, the famous Pisa lecture, where he said, in early work in generative grammar, it was assumed as a traditional grammar that there are rules such as passive, relativization, question formation. These rules are decomposed into the more fundamental elements of the subsystems of rules and principles. This is basically what we do. We try to say that things that have a label in language, like, again, for example, relative clause or imperative clause or anything like that, has to be decomposed as the result of a complex net that you can see. How can I give you an example of how thing works? Well, there is one very simple case, and it's to look at things like this. If I say John runs, the sentence is perfect. You have runs is singular, John is singular, so the two words stick together in a perfect way. Why John run does not, the two words does not stick together? Because John is singular and run is plural, and so the connection cannot be made. Now there is an interesting question, which is, as all interesting questions, comes from simple data. Is it always the case that the sequence John run is ungrammatical? No, because there is one property of human language which is very surprising. The relationship between two words change when something far from the two words happens. So in this case, if I add an extra word and I say those who love John run, the same sequence becomes good where it was bad in the first one. Now, this very simple fact, which is extremely simple, you don't need any advanced syntax in understanding that, forces you to understand that in order to describe how language works, you at least have to have two dimensions. The linear dimension is not sufficient, because in a linear dimension, you cannot express the idea that two words stay together if something very far happens. So what linguists do is they play with the bidimensional space, and they create things like sort of molecules of words. These molecules are called phrases. Most of you may have already seen them. Take, for example, a noun phrase. A noun phrase is something that is built around a name, a noun, in fact, a song. You can say, I know songs, or I know songs about love, or I know many songs, or I know many songs about love. It's like a planet song, where the two things about love and many gravitate around it. And these kind of things are the tools that the linguists use to express that bidimensionality that you need to understand that two words, when two words stay together, you have to explore something that happens at a distance with respect to the two words. If you use that, it is extremely simple to understand what was going on before, because these are the two structures that are assigned to the two sentences, John runs and those who love John run. In the first case, you just have to say, in both cases, in fact, you have to say that agreement is something that happens at two phrases that are at the same level in the structure. So you have John runs and those who love John runs. You cannot have agreement in between a verb phrase and the noun phrase, which is embedded in the structure. They have to be at the same, at the very same level. Well, you could ask me, didn't you tell us that you were telling us something about brain and language, and now you're taking us toward the realm of abstract trees of words, molecule of words? You're getting too metaphoric to our taste, but since you're not moving from your chairs, I take advantage of your kindness and I go on and ask you the following things. What do you think exists when you say that a phrase exists? Because this is a crucial question. And the answer to this question, all the research depends. I will not be so brave to suggest to you an answer to that. But I will reinforce my question by asking you the following thing. What do you think that exists when this exists? You know, it's clearly the case that an atom like that was not seen, touched, colored, or, you know, heard by scientists. It was a solution to a certain constellation of experiments that gave a coherent answer. So a phrase is exactly the same thing as an atom, in a sense. Remember, that's very delicate. And it's whether or not you accept this, you may have totally different paths throughout the research. In fact, on the neuropsychological reality of phrase structure, there has been extremely new experiments. One which is very is buried within another experiment that I'm going to show you in a minute was done by a group of people where I took a small part in experiment. And the other one, in fact, was a recent experiment led by Stanislav Dehaene and Christophe Payet, and was the first experiment that I know of where the computation of phrases was studied in a real increasing, let's say that the increasing of computation, of abstract computation, was compared with increasing of real computation in the brain. That to me was the first experiment ever done. But since you have Stan here, you can ask these things to him whenever you like, possibly. I will just tell you what we did in the other experiment. We did a very simple thing. The experiment was the following. The people had to hear stories in two languages. The languages were Italian and French, and Il Piccolo Principe was the story that was told in French, in Italian and French. So we had sentences like Il Piccolo Principe che m'ha posé beaucoup de questions, or Me le pericolo dei baobab. So all of a sudden, you had a switch from one language to other, and the switch, and this is the part that I suggested in the experiment, was the cut in between one part of the molecule or another part. And believe it or not, we had very different results. with respect to when we cut the first part or the other part. In particular, with the second part, the head and the complement, we had a typical reaction that you have when you have lexical representation, whereas in the other part, where we have the part on the left of the head and the head, we have the typical reaction that we have with syntax that, in fact, typically involves agreement. This is just to another way to tell you how we play with things, because remember, I have to figure out the property to play with to create an impossible language. This was the target. So consider this sentence: una foto di questo muro ha causato la rivolta di quella città. A picture of this wall has caused the riot of that city. I have taken away N, V, A, and P, substituted with X, assuming that the X was sort of ranging all over the possible elements of the structure. Now you see that this structure repeats itself on both branches of the tree till the whole structure is done. Now, this possibility to have a sort of a bubble system where you have one structure containing the same structure, containing the same structure, containing the same structure, is what linguists call recursion, and the property is what we may call quasi-autosimilarity. Autosimilarity is a mathematical property that has been recognized, for example, in this kind of representation. We see, for example, if you have a segment like that one, and you cut the segment in three parts and you build a triangle in between, in the central part, then you can do exactly the same thing in all the portions of the structure. This gives you a structure where a subpart of the structure contains the same information as the whole. Of course, you cannot that to ad infinitum with language, because you stop where you end with the words. But with mathematics, you can do it ad infinitum. This is the reason why I call quasi-autosimilarity. Now, autosimilarity or recursion have a very deep effect on language structure. Read that principle. No syntactic rule can refer to the specific position of a word in the linear sequence where it occurs. For us, it's kind of trivial. If we go out here and we go to one of the 1,000 bookstores that are in Paris and we buy, let's say, a grammar of Italian, we don't expect to find the grammar divided into rules for sentences of 8 words, rule for sentences of 9 words, and so on. It doesn't make any sense. We already know, as a fact, that rules do not depend on the number of words. This is a trivial fact, but as de Saussure said, trivial facts are always neglected. You know, people forget to think about these kind of things. So we got to the point, and then I'm rapidly going to the end. We have all the tools. Let me just remind you the path that we follow. The first step was to try to figure out a way to isolate syntax in the brain. Then we knew that syntax was not an artifact, and particularly it was a network that involved Broca's area plus the left nucleus caudatus. Not that we discovered where syntax is. We obviously just discovered one possible correlate of what the syntactic task is. This is to be sure about that. Then the second step was to say, well, then the absence of certain rule, is that conventional or not? What we did was to try to figure out if there were a property we could play with to create an impossible grammar. And this is exactly what we said, what we did. We tested, we taught a micro foreign language to subjects who never learned any. They were German native speakers of the ex-DDR who were only exposed to German, including among rules, impossible rules, that is non-structure dependent rules, that is rules that were not in a bubble framework as the one that I showed you. And then we compared the regional cortical blood flow of Broca's area during the grammaticality judgment of both possible and impossible rule. I want to just give you an example of what we did. So, for example, imagine that you are German, and you know that to say, I eat the pear, you say, ich esse die Birne, and then I tell you that in Italian you can drop the subject. And you can just say, mangio la pera, instead of saying, io mangio la pera. And then we told all the possible language. Then we came to a point where we said, well, take, for example, the kind of rule that you get when you have an interrogative construction. Interrogative construction is made by just reversing the order of an affirmative construction. Of course, we did not tell this German that there were some possible or impossible rule. It goes without saying it. It's interesting because when we got the experiment done and we had a good result, because otherwise I wouldn't be here to tell you, the reviewers wrote us back telling us that it was interesting, but it did only prove that Italian and German were both Indo-European languages. We could not tell them that kids, luckily for them, don't undergo courses of Romance linguistics or general linguistics when they're kids, but we were able to redo the experiment with Japanese. So, for example, we had sentences like "Paul isti bene," and we told them that in Japanese we had to say "Paul wa nashi o taberu." And then again, we got to the point where, for example, we told them the interrogative construction was done by reversing the order, and the interrogative construction corresponding to did Paul eat the pear was taberu o nashi wa Paul, and they learned it perfectly without making any particular effort, without making any particular error. So for them, it was equal. The experiment then was redone with three different groups. We've done that with these two languages. We redid that. This experiment was done by Maria Cristina Musso, who developed the technology, did the experiment in Jena and Hamburg. Then there was a second experiment done by Marco Tettamanti and Dorothea Weniger in Zurich. And then we redid a third experiment again in Milano, this time in Milano, comparing actually symbols that had no meaning. So we had real languages, the one in Zurich with word like le gulque, janige, le bral, and then we had the third experiment like this. In all the experiment, we had the following result. So this is the central image of this talk. How is this done? We have the following this line corresponds to the accuracy. So the farther you are from the center, the better you are in judging a rule. So I give you like a homework or a classwork, and I ask you whether this rule is used in correct way or not. And then on this line, the Y line, I get the blood flow in Broca's area. As you see here, the better you are with impossible rules, the lower is the amount of blood that you have in Broca's area, and which is exactly the opposite with possible rules. Now, the conclusion is obvious in this case. The conclusion is that since we cannot conventionally, artificially, or culturally control our brain physiology, we cannot immediately say that the distinction between the two rules could only be a cultural or conventional artifact. If it were so, the brain would not have given any answer. Now, did we gave an explanation for the major question? Probably not. We just saved the idea that the caveat suggested by Lenneberg in that quotation, when he said it must seem paradoxical to study language from a biological point of view, is false. We have to make sure, though, that we do not fall into another problem. That is, what did we see when we saw the activation of Broca's area? Did we see the center of language? Did we see a network where, did we see something where language, in a sense, was instantiated? Well, there is kind of a long sentence here that I'm going to read with you to try to share with you my perplexity or my worries about a sort of a new phrenological deduction. One must avoid the conclusion that Broca's area is the site where syntactic elaboration takes place. First of all, there is no site where anything takes place, but rather networks and preferential activation of areas in a modular fashion. Second, it could well be that Broca's area is just the crossroads where some path of complex net converge. So it's like when happen in cases where you have a big train station in a small town. How come this can be the case? Well, it could be the case because maybe there is an intersection of different train paths, and in that position you have a strong a strong activation in the network. I will just observe this very quickly and go to the conclusion. I will go back in the, well, actually, maybe I have one time to say one single thing here. We could ask ourselves in the next talk to next week, I will ask the most radical question of all. That is, why do we have syntax? After all, we could think of human languages as a repertoire of words where any combination makes sense. Why not? Wouldn't it be easier for us to communicate? Of course, we could have more sentences. For example, in Italian, with two words like Gianni and arriva, Gian arrive, we can have two sentences, Gianni arriva and arriva Gianni. In French and English, you cannot. You cannot say, I think that arrives John. In Italian, you can say, penso che arrivi Gianni. In French, you can say, je crois que arrive Jean. You have to have the subject preceding the predicate. Why is that so? Why is it the case that in certain languages, certain combination, couldn't it be that all languages, all sentences are computable? Well, actually, there is one, it's not an answer, it's just a suggestion that I make here, but at least it shows you that there could have been an advantage for our species to have languages that were not mutually understandable. In a moment where social making urban centers could have been very difficult because of the organization of things, maybe it's as difficult today, but it was certainly difficult. Having different languages was a way that preserved mankind from collapsing, most in the same sense as apoptosis allows cells cultivation to become smaller and manageable in a sense because they cannot communicate to each other. As I said, in the next talk, I would like to address you two aspects of this way of naturalizing Babel. The first one would be, what happens, why do we have syntax? Just to give you a hint of the problematic there, for the history of linguistics and of the Western civilization, we always had a pendulum shifting from two positions. For those who consider language as a reflex of the world on the mind, and those who consider the language as a property of human mind that is sort of independent of the structure of the world. In between these two poles moves linguistics, and I would like to show you where we are at now. And the second thing will be to try to ask to show you that we may find ourselves in a very strange situation when it comes to understanding what is the reason that gives us that bubbling structure that gives us syntax as opposed to other constructions. But nevertheless, let me just go to the last image and give you the conclusion. The absence of non-recursive languages cannot be considered a mere historical accident, nor a cultural or a conventional fact. This fact must correlate with the functional structure of the human brain, although we are still far from understanding the architecture of this correspondence. And then for those of you who don't know what to give for Christmas to their relatives, these are two books that you may want to read and give their gifts. Okay, thank you very much.